This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here it is, everything you need to know about business and the economy today.
Now I'd like to turn to the newest addition to the Apple family. And of course, I'm talking about the Apple Watch.
No, come on, we got more than that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on a Monday, everybody. It's the 9th of March, and the stock of the day today, no, not the watch company formerly known as a computer company, although we will get there later, never fear. The stock of the day is ticker symbol GM, General Motors, which makes, as you know, not watches or phones or computers, but cars. Does it pretty well of late, too. So well, in fact, that it's piled up $25 billion in cash in its various bank accounts. Nothing wrong with that, unless you're what's become known in the parlance as an activist investor. They don't want GM to hang on to that money. They want it themselves. And today they got their way. GM said it's going to pay out $5 billion in dividends to shareholders and another $5 billion buying back stock. From New York, Marketplace's Abri Benishore gets us going with the goods and the bads of the buyback.
A stock buyback is a thing you do, if you're a company, when you have a lot of cash.
Companies have been hoarding cash ever since the financial crisis. And one main reason for this is that companies are spooked.
Damian Park is managing partner of Hedge Fund Solutions.
And as a result, there is more cash on corporate balance sheets today than ever before.
When you have all this cash lying around, it's not uncommon for some investors to start to complain loudly. They might say, we're not getting enough return on our investment, or the company's not spending wisely. Stephen Davidoff Solomon teaches at UC Berkeley School of Law.
One of the ways the company responds to this is to say, look, we're trying to help our shareholders. We'll give them back some cash.
Please shut up. Here's some money.
I think that's a very good way to put it.
This can be really good if you're a stockholder. Ed Clissold is U.S. market strategist at Ned Davis Research.
The profits that the company makes is then spread out to fewer shares outstanding.
Meaning the fewer shares there are out there, the more valuable they become. The downside of using cash to buy back stocks is you're using cash to buy back stocks.
Companies could be doing other things with the cash.
Like saving it for the next economic crisis or spending it now.
Expanding their plants, they could be hiring more workers, paying them more, and that money could filter through to the economy.
But it's also a vote, says Clissold, that for better or worse, a company doesn't see many opportunities out there to invest in. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There are few things more fundamental to one's economic life in this country, once you get past life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I guess, than one's credit reports. If you've gotten a car loan or bought a house or applied for a credit card, you know its power. So the news today from New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman that the big three credit reporting agencies, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion by name, the news that they have agreed to change how they handle mistakes and some other data that goes into your report measures quite big on the consumer impact meter. So we've got personal finance expert Liz Weston here to explain a little bit about the news behind the news. Her book on the topic is called, appropriately enough, Your Credit Score. Hey, Liz, good to have you here.
Thanks, Kai.
So before we get to the nuts and bolts, this is a process that will put humans into a highly automated process, right?
That's absolutely true. And that's the big deal. If you had a dispute before, basically the only time a human would get involved is when they put a three-digit number or a code on your dispute, send it off to the lenders. If the lender said, no, my information's correct, the consumer's wrong, you were basically out of luck. I mean, you could keep going back and forth, but the fact is there wasn't anybody there to kind of step in and say, be the middleman, as it were.
Other than medical debt, what else is on my credit score that I may frankly not know about?
Well, all kinds of things can wind up there. I had an overdue library book wind up on
one. You're making that up. Seriously?
Seriously.
That's like not even funny then.
No, and it made a big difference in the score at that particular credit bureau.
Yeah.
They only reported it to one. But yeah, there was like a 70-point difference in my scores.
Wow.
Yeah.
What if I get a parking ticket and the city of Los Angeles takes me to court?
That's another one. Doesn't even have to take you to court. If you simply don't pay it, it can be turned over to a collection agency. That's where a lot of people get stung, is the things they're not expecting.
Well, so what am I supposed to do? I mean, life is busy, we're running around, and you miss a bill or whatever, you're not a scofflaw, but come on.
Yeah,
exactly. What do you do?
Well, the credit bureaus and the credit score creators all say this is predictive, that if you let a little thing go, you're going to let big things go. So and while they have that attitude, it's really, really tough. Now, some versions of some credit scores ignore those little collection accounts.
Yeah.
The latest versions of the FICO score do that. So if it's under 100 bucks, not a huge deal. But lenders use all kinds of versions of all kinds of credit scores, so you never know what's going to come back and bite you.
How long do we think this will take until what has been proposed or announced today is actually happening in the real world?
Well, the reports I've been reading said 3.5 years is how long they have to roll it out. Now, we don't know which provisions will come into effect when, so you can't expect it to happen immediately is the short version.
What do they have to do? They have to train the human beings, I suppose.
Well, yeah, maybe even hire some. Wouldn't that be good thing
and
for
and the unemployment rate would get changed.
Yeah, there we go.
When you look at your credit score, which I assume you do with some regularity, I do not as often as I should, what do you look for?
Well, actually, credit scores are different from credit reports, and a lot of people get that mixed up.
Okay.
The credit report is the actual information, you know? The credit score is what's created for that information.
Got it.
So that number just tells you vaguely where you stand with lenders. And again, all lenders are different. So one might think a 680 score is fine. The other might not want to deal with you. And it also depends on the product. You know, are you going for a high-end credit card? Are you going for a mortgage? All those things make a difference. In general, though, you want that higher score because it means less interest on any loans you get. Yeah. It means lower utility deposits. It means it's easier to get a cell phone. I mean, all these things are easier. In some states, in most states, as a matter of fact, it affects your insurance premium as well. So this is not something that you want to mess with. You want to know what it is and make sure that it's good.
Liz Weston, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Kai.
Friday's malaise over a good February jobs report and the possibility of rising interest rates sooner rather than later. Yeah, that was all bygones on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a list in Fortune magazine that I saw at the end of last year, the 10 fields with the most job openings. You had a couple of different healthcare jobs, of course. There were some software jobs, developers and network administrators as well, but also sales, just straight ahead selling whatever it is that your company makes. That is, there's more demand for salespeople than there is supply to fill it, which is really bad because for most companies, no sales means no revenue. From Birmingham, Alabama, Gigi Duban reports.
Everything at Daxco is heavily branded.
Beth Wolf is the talent acquisition specialist at Daxco, a software company in Birmingham. Daxco is growing, so Wolf is recruiting for 2 sales jobs. At her desk, she pulls out a small stack of resumes. She's got notes scribbled all over them.
You know, this one I wrote kind of like uses a lot of buzzwords. So, somebody who kind of has done their homework about like what to say about sales and, knows all the right words, but didn't have a whole lot of substance.
Filling these positions is very much on the front burner, Wolf says.
We consider our sales and our tech roles right now to be like our highest priority as far as like filling, because obviously without those sales, we're not going to stay afloat.
She says she doesn't think it'll take more than another couple of weeks to hire some folks. That's the hope anyway, because here's the challenge. You've got your salespeople and your tech people. But finding that person who's both?
I mean, there are fantastic salespeople out there who just have a hard time picking up on the tech.
Brent Thompson is managing partner with Peak Sales Recruiting. His company places people in all kinds of sales jobs. But he says the tech sector is especially hungry for top talent.
The demand is extremely great. Although there are a lot of people in sales, that does not mean they are all good.
Part of that's because technology is constantly changing. But also, sales isn't what it used to be either.
There's still some people who think it's somebody who tells cheesy jokes and walks in with coffee and donuts. But I think the world has evolved.
Now, he says, buyers are a lot more educated. And they want more substance, less dog and pony show. But old stereotypes die hard. And that's keeping a lot of would-be salespeople out of the profession. The University of Alabama at Birmingham's Center for Sales Leadership is where students learn to sell.
We are assertive, but we are not overbearing. If they say no, we don't pull our hammer out and hit them over the head. We can ask them questions.
John Hansen is director of the program. In class, he tells students how to handle rejection, what to do when a buyer says, I don't have time to think about it right now, and how to move in for the close without seeming pushy. The students laugh because pushy is exactly what comes to mind when they think about salespeople. But also, Hansen says, a lot of students see sales jobs as way too much pressure.
Graduating students are nervous. The majority of students we have in the program, even though they've chosen sales, they're still a bit nervous about the fact that a large percentage of their compensation may be tied to how they perform.
Jeremy Barnes is a senior at UAB. He's majoring in industrial distribution with a minor in mechanical engineering, just the kind of student a tech company would snap up for sales. But to that, he says, no thanks.
Coming into this, I kind of knew I'd never wanted to be a salesman.
He used to sell home security products. He says it wasn't for him.
Even though I believe I'd be great at it, the pressure of it, and I think there's other skills I have that can help me in other ways.
For one thing, he says he didn't like pushing people into buying stuff so he could have more money in his pocket. And he says these jobs, especially the entry-level ones, seem like revolving doors.
I'm more looking for security. I really am, long-term security.
So if that means being the middleman between the sales staff and the engineers, he'll take it. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And now people are saying, where's my robot to wash my windows? Where's my robot to mow my lawn?
They're coming sooner rather than later. That's where they are. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 0.75% today, 138 points, ended at 17,995. The NASDAQ bumped up 0.3%, 15 points, 49.42. The S&P 500 hiked 0.3%, higher 8 points, finished at 2,079. Deal news drove the markets today. News of Alcoa's plans to buy RTI International Metals for $1.5 billion pushed RTI up nearly 40%. Alcoa finished down more than 5%. We mentioned General Motors earlier. Investors are already salivating at the idea of all that money flowing back their way. Stock ended up 3% today. Apple? Oh, yeah, Apple bounced up and down ahead of the launch on the Apple iWatch, but also, you know, during the launch, ended up just 0.33%. Microsoft up 1% today. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.18%. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues job openings and labor turnover data for January. We're waiting to see what happens to his character when Mad Men starts up next month. John Hamm turns 44. And it's International Bagpipe Day, observed with music, of course. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Apple CEO Tim Cook took his sweet old time with the watch today. Waited about an hour into the presentation in San Francisco before he got to it. But when he did cut right to the chase.
The Apple Watch is the most personal device we have ever created. It's not just with you, It's on you.
That does kind of sum up Apple's challenge with this thing, right? Because when the Apple Watch goes on sale in April, starting price $349, by the way, and gets steeply more expensive from there, when it goes on sale, what's it going to mean for the company's much ballyhooed retail operations as it gets into the luxury technology slash jewelry market? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
I headed to the Apple store in downtown Portland. It's the typical huge glass cube. Really has changed the way retail looks. The question, can they sell watches from a store like this?
I put this question to Ian Schur, executive editor at CNET.
Watch stores are very luxurious places.
And secure, the expensive merchandise tucked away in locked cases. Apple stores, not so much. They're cutting edge and helter-skelter busy, says Schur, offering just a few devices and sizes to try out, not at all like shopping for jewelry at a boutique or fancy department store. And that could be a problem for Apple, but only if they're trying to go after a traditional, well-heeled luxury consumer, says James McQuivey at Forrester Research.
That Rolex buyer wants to go into a dealer. They want to have a personal conversation over some cherry wood desk. But what Apple is going to do is steal the next Rolex buyer, the one that's 33 today.
A buyer who's used to Apple's look, it's young salespeople giving you the straight scoop on memory and features. McQuivey expects the store layouts and displays to change to showcase the watches as fashion. And he thinks those store folks will have to change their spiel a bit.
Get those Apple in-store salespeople to say, oh, well, while you're here, just try this on. It looks great on you.
It might be a hard sell, especially for middle-aged consumers, even those very familiar with Apple technology. I met Sharon Place outside the Portland Apple store today.
I like to wear a conventional watch. I like to wear, you know, bracelets.
What she doesn't want, she says, is her personal technology adorning her wrist. The Apple Watch app is available to download today. The watch itself will be available to try on in the store and pre-order April 10th. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
A story now about two things that often go together, money and politics. Senator Robert Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, said in a hastily arranged press conference Friday night that he is not going anywhere, despite reports that he will soon face corruption charges in connection with campaign contributions from a doctor down in Florida. The particulars of this case will be litigated, of course, or otherwise settled somehow. But broadly speaking, how do the courts make that separation between campaign contributions and political corruption? From Washington Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
So it's not all in your head. Members of Congress do give campaign donors special access. At least that's what Berkeley PhD student Josh Calla found out in a 2013 study.
So we went into the study trying to see, does money lead to unequal political outcomes?
He sent emails to almost 200 members of Congress from real constituents requesting a meeting. Calla says half were identified as donors. They were much more likely to get a meeting.
Yeah, it was about a threefold increase, I believe.
Next, Calla wants to study whether political contributions actually influence legislation. Bribe investigations consider a number of factors, according to Richard Berfault, a professor of legislation at Columbia Law School.
So I think timing can be a factor.
As in, did a member of Congress get a political donation right before or after voting on a bill? Was there a quid pro quo?
There have been undercover deals, outright handshakes. Sometimes it's provable, but in other situations, it's a lot grayer.
Donors know how to exploit the gray areas. Larry Noble is now senior counsel at the Campaign Legal Center. Before that, he worked as a private attorney, advising clients on how to make legal political donations.
When you're making a political contribution, never discuss an issue. What that means as a practical matter is the contribution is made and then the lobbying takes place the next day.
Then the lobbyist can say, contribution? What contribution? I'm just exercising my right to free speech. No laws broken here. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Christmas was going on 10 weeks ago now, and if you bought something for somebody that involved a rebate, chances are you're about to get that check in the mail. Retailers and manufacturers spend millions of dollars trying to get us to buy whatever it is that they're selling, and rebates are a favorite tool. From WABE in Atlanta, Georgia, Jim Burris explains why that is.
Okay, this is a story about rebates, but really, it's about hoops.
I'm here with Debbie Fitzgerald, who lives in a northern suburb of Atlanta, and we have a hula hoop. So my question for you, Debbie, is if I am a retailer and you are you, the customer, What would I have to do to get you to jump through this hoop, also known as a rebate?
Actually, I would do anything to jump through that hoop. I really would. If it was a rebate, I'm doing it 100%.
Fitzgerald had already decided a few weeks ago to buy an LG phone from her local Verizon retailer. When the salesperson mentioned the $50 mail-in rebate, it became game on.
It was like taking a test, you know, at the DMV. You're like, I cannot fail this. I cannot fail this exam because I want my money back. So there's a little bit of pressure on making sure I did it right.
With $50 at stake, there's a good bet most consumers would take the time to get it right. But would we bite at, say, just a few bucks? Maybe, says Harvard Business School marketing professor John Gorville.
You're in a store, you look at a package, and it says $5 with the $2 rebate. And you say, hey, that's a pretty good deal. I'm getting 40% off.
Gorville studied the psychology of that thought process, and he found people who want the item anyway often use a rebate to justify the purchase. In their heads, they effortlessly jump through hoops. So cutting off the proof of purchase, taping it to a section on the rebate form, filling in serial numbers, and slapping down a stamp, no problem. But after the purchase, reality sets in. It can be a hassle.
The cynical perspective is they would prefer to make it difficult so you don't actually redeem. I think that is a fairly fair assessment.
In the past, there was a push to sometimes not have rebates fulfilled.
Jason Adkins is CEO of 360 Incentives, a rebate fulfillment company. And he says hassle used to be a built-in part of the rebate game. But he says manufacturers view rebates a bit differently now.
In today's world, with a rebate, you can have up to 8 touch points with that consumer, which is very different than the old world.
Back in the day, rebates involved one-way communication to a P.O. box. Well, now much of the process is online. For example, you can opt into text message updates. If you choose that, chances are you're comfortable engaging with a smartphone, and knowing that is valuable to companies.
Now with, you know, technology online, email, text messaging, we can actually have a conversation with the consumer.
And with rebates taking 6, 8, or even 10 weeks to fulfill, it's a long conversation. The reason it takes so long to process your money back? Fraud. Adkins says people fake about 1 out of every 10 submissions. Looks like rebate companies have their own hoops to jump through. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Imagine, if you will, the perhaps not too distant future. You've got an electric car. Maybe it's self-driving. You can summon it with your Apple Watch, perhaps. You look up as you step outside in the morning, and what do you see but a swarm of drones going to and fro? Helen Greiner, for one, would gladly welcome that. Greiner was a co-founder of iRobot, the company that invented the Roomba, that little vacuuming robot. She is now the CEO of Sci-Fi Works, a robotics and drone builder that is betting very heavily on that not-too-distant future. Helen, thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's great to be here.
What is it about robotics and drones and this whole field that does it for you?
Oh, I've been involved with robots since I saw Star Wars when I was 11 and wanted to build R2-D2. You know, at the end of the day, your creations, quote-unquote, come to life. And that's a really, really exciting feeling.
There's this great phrase that you said that I read as I was getting ready for our talk. You said there's this corridor above the treetops that's just waiting for the drones.
Waiting for the drones and waiting to do the drone delivery. I think some of your listeners heard Bezos go and say that drones will be delivering packages. And some might have been skeptical, think it was a marketing stunt, but it's not. There's no reason drones won't be delivering packages. Instead of waiting for a few days to get that package, you can get it in 30 minutes.
Except what's going to have to happen is that we as a society are going to have to get used to that idea.
Yeah, I think the Roomba is a great example of that, right? It was the first autonomous consumer robot. It's one of the ones that I brought to market at iRobot. Mm-hmm. And the big lessons were ease of use, right? Instead of, you know, just another tech toy, consumers start thinking of it as, I can use that in my house.
Yeah. Although, you know, with the Roomba, I mean, you started that company, you started iRobot in 1990. You didn't take it public until 15 years later. You said it was the longest overnight sensation in history. I mean, it takes a while, right? There's a long runway toward public acceptance and then getting these things commercialized.
that iRobot, we were really on the vanguard. But now I think it's changed for multiple reasons. One is that a lot of people have bought drones as a consumer product, and they go out and fly them.
My kids have one. It's fun, you know?
Exactly. Or they see a neighbor fly them, or they see somebody down at the beach fly them, or in the park fly them, and they say, well, I see how small it is, I see how compelling it is, I see how much fun it is. And then you have people talking about compelling applications like drone delivery, and people start thinking, wow, this is going to do something for me. It's going to make my life easier. And now people are saying, where's my robot to wash my windows? Where's my robot to mow my lawn?
Not to get all apocalyptic here, but are you sensitive to the worries that some people have that these things are eventually going to wind up doing some kind of harm, whether it's sheer liability, these things falling out of the sky, or something else?
Well, I think that brings up a good point. As you might have heard, the FAA just put out some rules that allow initial commercial operations, and they don't go as far as some people would like. We haven't proven to the FAA that they're going to be reliable enough to fly over a city autonomously, but I believe we will get there. And the great news is the FAA seemed very open to modifying the rules and upgrading them along the way as we prove reliability, as we prove safety, being able to take on more and more applications.
I wonder what success for you in this field looks like.
Oh, success I measure as ubiquitous drones doing all kinds of tasks, from like the little drone that's in your pocket to monitoring and managing every facility, to drone delivery, getting your fast food or that critical item for your barbecue delivered by drone.
That critical item. Can it bring me beer? That's the question.
That's a request we get a lot from robots.
Helen Greiner, she is the CEO of Sci-Fi Works out of Boston, Massachusetts. Helen, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the acknowledgement that while I, much like the next person, really enjoy it being lighter later now that daylight saving time is upon us, there's not much evidence changing the clocks actually saves anything. A study that I saw today in Quartz points out that electricity use in Indiana, once that state decided to get with the national program and adopt daylight saving in 2006, study showed that electricity use actually went up a full percent when it did so. Also, it being darker early, that's just really depressing.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And with that, we are done on this Apple Watch Day. The Dow up 0.75%, 138 points. The NASDAQ bumped up 0.3%. That is 15 points. The S&P 500, 0.3% higher at the bell. That is 8 points there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.